We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
England's big relaxation of COVID restrictions, among them social distancing and face masks, is finally here. The government has called the changes an important step, but warned the public to be cautious.
This is a virus that is highly infectious, so we have to be careful, we have to remain vigilant. There is no perfect time to take this step. This is as good a time as any, as Chris Whitty has said.
However, many scientists disagree with the timing of this step into the unknown. More than 1,200 international experts have called it an unethical experiment and a threat to the world. The unlocking of England is happening even as the country's Prime Minister and Chancellor become the latest government officials to go into self-isolation over the weekend. Following contact with new Health Secretary Sajid Javid, who tested positive for the virus before them. The two were originally reported as exempt from quarantining, as they were joining a daily contact testing pilot, but did a quick U-turn shortly after.
But we can also see that they don't believe in their own narrative. It's very plain that they do not believe that this self-isolation would protect them or anybody else that they might have responsibility for. So the first reaction is to grab for something that gets them out of it.
Arrest the police! Arrest them!
The so-called Freedom Day met a protest outside the country's parliament, with the protesters calling for the Prime Minister to be arrested.
All this at a time when virus cases in the UK are in another rapid upswing, with one of the top scientific advisors to the government warning that the country is headed into the biggest COVID wave yet. Saeed Pariza, London.
How safe are our mobile phones? This is a question many activists and journalists have been pondering for some time now. And according to an investigation by 17 media organizations, it appears that many of their worst fears have been confirmed.
Their investigation found that human rights activists, journalists and lawyers across the world were targeted by authoritarian states using hacking software sold by Israeli surveillance company NSO Group. The spyware, referred to as Pegasus, acts as malware, infecting mobile phones, enabling operators to extract crucial information and secretly activate microphones.
So they're not just tracking criminals, but they're also tracking any professionals who are doing the job professionally, but the fear of being exposed by these journalists. And you become an enemy.
Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Rwanda are the states that have been accused of purchasing the controversial software, with allegations that the hacking device was used on the phone of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi before he was hacked to pieces inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Khashoggi's close friends were also believed to have their phones surveilled soon after his murder.
And in Khashoggi's case, this is clear. What he was doing is to expose the dirty things happening in Saudi Arabia. But obviously, the kingdom, and also the regime, the establishment, is not happy. And when an establishment is not happy, obviously they have all the resources to keep you quiet or to get rid of you.
If these allegations are proven to be true, it will indicate surveillance on a global level from Budapest to Riyadh that is not only a major world crime, but also an attack on the principle of holding authoritarian states to account. Ahmed Kibala, London.
Bilateral ties between Pakistan and a beleaguered government in Kabul have witnessed another low after Kabul recalled its ambassador and other senior diplomats from Islamabad, citing security concerns. It happened after the daughter of Afghan envoy to Islamabad was briefly kidnapped and released. The incident, according to police, happened during her back and forth movements on several cabs she herself hired for her travel between Islamabad and nearby city of Rawalpindi. The diplomatic row has preceded extraordinary territorial gains by Taliban, who now claim to have taken over 85% of Afghan territory following the exit of almost all US-led NATO troops from Afghanistan. Kabul has blamed Islamabad to have done little to contain the movements of Afghan Talibans from its nearly 2,700-kilometer-long porous border.
Networks and organizations supporting the Taliban are openly celebrating the destruction of the assets and capabilities of the Afghan people and state. Also, we call on Pakistan to use its influence and leverage for peace and cessation of hostilities.
Islamabad has repeatedly accused President Ashraf Ghani's government and India together to have provided sanctuaries in Afghanistan to anti-Pakistan terrorists who killed tens of thousands of people in this part of the world over the years.
No country has tried harder to get Taliban on the dialogue table than Pakistan. We have made every effort, short of taking military action against Taliban and Pakistan, we have made every effort to get them on the dialogue table and to have a peaceful settlement there. To blame Pakistan for what is going on in Afghanistan, I feel, is extremely unfair. Why would they listen to us when they are sensing victory?
Pakistani officials say that Taliban listen to them, but they do not control them. And over the years, Islamabad has lost significant influence on them. However, Kabul is not willing to accept this argument, given the ongoing military campaign by the Taliban, recapturing districts after districts with little resistance from the security forces in neighboring Afghanistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Palestinian national and Islamic groups in the Gaza Strip held a gathering near the separation fence to slam Israel for stalling the flow of goods to the enclave. Attended by a number of Palestinian resistance leaders, the gathering voiced a resistance refusal of the Israeli attempts to provoke Palestinian outrage by widening the current blockade on the crossings connecting Gaza to the outside world.
This is a message to the Israeli regime to stop us working in anger among Palestinians by imposing further restrictions on the reconstruction process in Gaza after latest escalation. What happened during the escalation might happen again, and the resistance is ready to defend Palestinians' rights under any condition. This inhumane siege is unacceptable. Our economy is already collapsed and things here are not bearable anymore.
Palestinian resistance called mediators and international community to redouble efforts to pressurize Israel into removing especially its restriction on building materials and construction work. The Israeli strikes displaced nearly 80,000 Gazans, including children, and destroyed 17,000 homes.
This Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life in Gaza. It has brought only further poverty and unemployment. Israeli regime is punishing our civilians twice, first by destroying their homes and second by denying reconstruction materials to them.
Palestinian resistance has warned that the new pressure by Israel will intensify the current tensions. They say are considering all options to break the siege.
It is unacceptable for Palestinians to remain silent towards this inhumane blockade that has only increased the poverty rate in Gaza. We call on the international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end this blockade. International community must stand for the humanity principles which have been violated by Israel in Gaza.
Israel imposed its suffocating siege on Gaza in 2007 after Hamas took control of the enclave in an election. Palestinians here say the delay in construction will affect the economic situation of Palestinian families, especially those who've lost their homes, by pushing up poverty rates. They also stress that the Israeli moves to impede the construction work in Gaza might trigger fresh violence. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
On the day of Arafat, Yemen Scholars Association held a symposium in the Great Mosque of Sana'a. The symposium entitled Preventing Hajj is a Deterrent from the Grand Mosque and the Service of the Nation's Enemies denounced the Saudi regime's ban on foreigners from Hajj. A large number of Yemeni scholars attended the event.
This move serves the Zionist interests. There is a great conspiracy against Muslims. The Saudi regime has deviated from the path of Islam. All Muslims must get united to protect their sanctities against the Zionist plots.
The Scholars Association issued a statement accusing the Saudi regime of serving the Zionist agenda by targeting Muslims' rights. The statement also condemned the silence of the Islamic nations toward the Saudi practices against Islam.
The decision to ban millions of Muslims from Hajj pilgrimage is in line with the colonial projects. The colonial powers seek to change the nature of Islamic sites. We condemn and deplore the silence of the Islamic countries around the world towards a deliberate targeting of Islamic sanctities. We call on all Muslims to condemn what the Saudi regime is doing.
For the second year, Saudi Arabia prevented millions of Muslims from holding Hajj pilgrimage, saying this step comes amid the precautions against the COVID-19 pandemic, whilst thousands of people attend music concerts in Riyadh and Jeddah without any restrictions.
Yemenis believe that the Saudi regime is deliberately targeting the rights of Muslims, including the Hajj, as part of implementing the Israeli agenda in the region. They say Saudi Arabia has no right to ban millions of Muslims from their right to access Holy Mecca. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Spotlight.
An Israeli spyware has been used to spy on human rights activists and journalists worldwide. It has also targeted the phones of French, Iraqi, and Moroccan leaders, among others. The obvious question is whether this was done with the knowledge of Israeli authorities or not. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at how this spying software was used by dictatorial regimes like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, in which, in the case of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince used it to spy on slain dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
How safe are our mobile phones? This is a question many activists and journalists have been pondering for some time now, and according to an investigation by 17 media organizations, it appears that many of their worst fears have been confirmed.
Their investigation found that human rights activists, journalists, and lawyers across the world were targeted by authoritarian states using hacking software sold by Israeli surveillance company NSO Group. The spyware, referred to as Pegasus, acts as malware, infecting mobile phones, enabling operators to extract crucial information and secretly activate microphones.
Press TV spoke to global security expert Alex Okoman about what all this means.
So they're not just tracking criminals, but they're also tracking any professionals who are doing the job professionally, but the fear of being exposed by these journalists, and you become an enemy.
Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Rwanda are the states that have been accused of purchasing the controversial software, with allegations that the hacking device was used on the phone of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi before he was hacked to pieces inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Khashoggi's close friends were also believed to have their phones surveilled soon after his murder.
And in Khashoggi's case, this is clear. What he was doing is to expose the dirty things happening in Saudi Arabia, but obviously the kingdom and also the regime, the establishment, is not happy. And when an establishment is not happy, obviously they have all the resources to keep you quiet or to get rid of you.
If these allegations are proven to be true, it will indicate surveillance on a global level from Budapest to Riyadh that is not only a major world crime, but also an attack on the principle of holding authoritarian states to account. Ahmed Kibala, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker, who joins us, who's a member of ACT Now to Stop War and End Racism. We also have Elijah Magnier, who's a veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia and also North Africa. All right, let me first come to you, Elijah Magnier. Let's review what this software is and its purpose. It's an Israeli company, NSO. It's made a software that's called Pegasus. Pegasus is a malware, according to the description given, that infects iOS and Android devices, which enables the operators of that to extract messages, to extract photos, emails, to record calls, and secretly, and that's the key word there, activate the microphones and also activate the cameras. So based on that, isn't it safe to conclude that the purpose of this software is spying or surveilling?
Thank you for having me. I spoke to different European experts in security, and I've been told that this spyware, malware, exists since many years. And what is not said in the report distributed or released recently is every single European country has it. And every single European country needs to seek a permission from Israel to give it to another state, even if it is a friendly state. Without the permission of Israel, this can't happen. So every single European country is not only spying on its citizens, but is spying on the same European and non-European leaders. And the problem of this spying program is it turns the phone on, even if you switch your phone off, and it turns the camera, it's a GPS, it indicates the location, it downloads the email, all the messages, all the voice messages, written messages. Even when you talk, this can be exactly copied by this software and sent to the surveillance agency. And there is more than one surveillance agency in every country who can tap into use this software and use it against their citizens. Therefore, more than one agency has this spying device that is used not only against journalists, but against everyone who is considered interesting for the security services. And that's a clear violation of human rights, clear violation of the privacy, and it is just destroy the word of democracy and freedom of expression here. And what is more serious about it is every single European country knows about it and is aware of its presence and is also knowledgeable that other countries are using it. And when these are using it against heads of state, we learned that even Macron's phone, the French president, was under surveillance. And we also know that head of state and prime ministers in the Middle East, each one was under the scrutiny of a secret service in one country or another. So basically, everything is exposed. And the last bit here is there is no phone that is not breakable, including what iPhone was saying, that the latest phone is really very solid and protected, and this turned out to be a lie.
Uh-huh. Well, Richard Beckert, so we can then conclude that this spyware was used to target journalists. Aside from what Elijah Magnier has said, you have a consortium of 17 media outlets, activists, researchers who have found this really company software to target, as our guest Sarah Elijah Magnier said, the smartphones of these activists and journalists and executives, and of course some of those leaders includes 10 prime ministers. So can we establish that at this point to say that it's no longer an allegation, this is indeed true?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that it's true. I mean, there is an agreement among multiple prominent media in the world and organizations that have investigated this. And so the denials that come from the NSO in the state of Israel that their program has been used to identify, to follow, target, to surveil people rings very hollow. This is something that the state of Israel has obviously used program or very similar programs. And one way you can know that is that when Israel carries out its bombing of Gaza, which is defenseless against that bombing, but when they do, very often, not all the time, but sometimes, they call up the people who are in a building that's going to be struck and tell them, you have 10 minutes to get out, we're going to bomb. It appears that Israel has created through either this surveillance program or very, very similar ones, the capacity to identify virtually where everyone is in the Palestinian areas of the state, or in the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's so much behind this that I'd like to break open. And Elijah Magnier, one of the things that I'd like to find out from you, if I can, you know, the company itself says that it vets the buyers of this, despite the fact that we have seen how this has been sold to regimes that have poor human track records. Elijah Magnier, are you with us? Okay, let me go to you, Richard Becker. So when it says that it does that, we know that the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have purchased this. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because the million-dollar question here, Richard Becker, is the fact if Israel is actually involved here. I mean, based on what has been disclosed, Israel does play a role in terms of the clients that this company can sell its software to. And multiple sources have actually corroborated that the fact that they pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of the customers. And it says that the group actually did not want to pursue Saudi Arabia any longer as a client, or the UAE. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure where that's coming from, but it's, you know, we can see that the UAE, which Israel has just very triumphantly opened relations with, despite it, you know, it's really something, I just have to say parenthetically, United Arab Emirates is a country of about 11 million people, and about 10 million of them are forbidden ever to become citizens of that country, and it's a police state, and the idea that they're not using this kind of equipment to track opponents is belied by the fact that we have that the ruler of Dubai and the prime minister of United Arab Emirates just They just sent commandos, you know, very recently to capture his daughter, who didn't want to live under that kind of a system and escape. And they found her using this technology, either her own phone or the phone of some of her aides, in international waters, and brought her back. And she, you know, so she's suffering from that. I mean, a lot of people are suffering probably much worse fates than she has so far. But I think that that particular case shows that, you know, that it makes it clear that this equipment, this program has been supplied to the UAE. And also, it seems quite clear that it's been supplied to the another extremely repressive government where there's no freedom for people, and that's the government of Saudi Arabia.
Well, Elijah Magnier, let me ask you this, because we have to establish this. And it's very confusing somewhat that you have this software company that's based out of Israel, and this is where the line is a little bit blurred. And I'd like to find out from you, based on that French organization that revealed, that studied this case and investigated it and revealed some of the facts that we have in this conversation right now, that Israel and its officials were actually choosing the clients for the software. It was saying, you have to sell it to Saudi Arabia, you have to sell it to the UAE. And it says that the software company says, it wasn't even up to us. We don't want to sell it to authoritarian regimes. But Israeli officials were making us do that. So does that show intent from Israel to have these regimes like UAE and Saudi Arabia use the device to spy on journalists, politicians, etc.? Is Israel guilty?
This is a very good question. There are many points here. The first point is this company has been established in 2010. The revelation that there is a spyware developed by Israel and offered to European and non-European countries came out in 2016. This is indicate that Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, have already established good relationship with Israel to be given spyware that is highly sophisticated. However, the other side of this spyware is whatever the countries are spying on, it is again related to the same company who can collect the same data. So basically, to explain better, Israel is providing this spyware, but it is in a position to collect the data that each country with the authorization to use the spyware, and this country is collecting the information. This information is also shared with Israel. Therefore, Israel is collecting a bank of information that is huge, coming from different countries who are supposed to be friendly countries, because they need an authorization from Israel to release it. This is when I talked to security officers. They told me that we are not entitled to give it to any other country without the permission of Israel. So there is no secret here. The Israelis are willingly giving this spyware to countries they consider friendly, with whom they also share data. So these countries like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, they are sharing the spyware data, spy information, and collecting data and giving it also to Israel.
So, Richard Becker, I'm guessing that there's something illegal about this. I would think that that's a conclusion that can be made here. And therefore, based on that, what can be done? I mean, I'm not sure what word to use when I ask the question, what can be done when we're looking at countries like the U.S., France, and U.K. selling arms to these same regimes that are killing people in Yemen, for example, and yet we have here a case where it's still continuing to this day.
Well, it's really something. I mean, it's outrageous what's happening. There has to be an outcry from people in many countries against this, and a demand that it end. But it probably will not end. It's probably going to continue. I mean, just today, I think Israel is now functioning kind of like a 21st century Sparta. There's reports today that all the top officers from all the military services in the U.S. are in Utah, and they've gathered there in Utah to see a demonstration of a new loitering drone, loitering weapon that Israel has developed apparently was used in the by the Azerbaijani forces in the war against Armenia. And this weapon also has a what they call a very high degree of autonomy, meaning that it may kill on its own. It has the capacity to do that without getting orders. But this is what's happening. This is what contributions to the world that we're getting, not only from Israel, but from other weapons manufacturers and surveillance manufacturers, but particularly coming from Israel, are some of the most advanced forms of surveillance and weaponry to the detriment of people in the world. And people should know this. They should know that this is what's happening. And one other connection, I believe that this firm, the NSO firm, is owned by an equity fund based in New York. So there's another connection, a big connection. That's who the company's real owners are.
Yeah, indeed, that's actually a great topic for another edition of the Spotlight here. Okay, so we've covered that, Elijah, to some length. But then you have the other issue that's involved here, and it involves not to bring up Saudi Arabia and the UAE so much, but that, again, I'm basing this on the report by Citizen Lab, where it said that they have been using this software extensively, and based on the report that I'm reading over here, it said that the usage was actually significantly to have increased between the years 2016 and August of 2018, and the increase was used to spy on their own citizens. Why do you think that the UAE and Saudi Arabia would need to use this software that's powerful in so many ways on their own citizens?
That's a very good question, because the regimes are fragile, and because there is no democracy in the country, and because anyone that belongs to the opposition or voices an opposition voice is immediately taken in prison and condemned harshly. So these countries need to spy on their citizens to make sure that they can oppress any opposition group or individual who they think it represents a danger to the national security of the country. Therefore, we again talking about spying illegally, and there is no freedom of expression in these countries. Inevitably, they need to know what's happening and who's against or with the regime. And also they need to know who is in contact with whom abroad. And this is again a share of information, of intelligence information between states who very much know that this state is spying on citizens, and the information is shared with democratic states in Western countries, knowingly that this information has been obtained illegally. Now, the best way to avoid it, and that was amusing when you ask it, is simply not to carry a smartphone.
I'll never forget the headline that I read, Richard Becker. This is going back quite some time, in which the CIA said, based on the headline, "We're going to spy on you through your refrigerator," in which it said household appliances like dishwashers or ovens, stereo and TVs, can be used to spy. Is spying then just the norm? Is spying on whether it's UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the U.S. on citizens something that needs to be done in order for there to be a watch on the citizens of these countries?
Well, you know, I don't think it's just those countries either. I think that if we really look at the United States, the most powerful country in the world, there's crisis after crisis after crisis, and often multiple crises taking place at the same time. That's the truth of the matter, and it's really the system that exists in the world today, and the inequality that exists in the world today, is outrageous. It's beyond description. You have four individuals in the United States who have as much wealth as the bottom 165 million people. That's not a sustainable situation. So I think that we're going to see, I think the reality is that the governments from Saudi Arabia to the United Arab Emirates to Israel to the United States to France, they're all going to rely increasingly on surveillance and repression. These systems have to be changed. It cannot go on like this. These are, you know, the systems that are really destroying the world and destroying the rights of people all over the world. But I think they're going to rely on this, and we have to find the ways to organize, and that's taking place, to bring about a new system.
Final question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. You know, when we take a look at the result of what has happened in some sense out of this surveillance, if you want to call it that, we have to bring up the case of Jamal Khashoggi, in which Saudi Arabia used this software and obviously gathered data and information on him, of which we know obviously what the end result of that was. So that has happened. We still have Saudi Arabia and this company is to cooperate with each other, or for Saudi Arabia to continue using its software. What is it going to take so this doesn't happen? I mean, Saudi Arabia is still on a path of trying to silence dissent of its critics.
There is no way to stop it, unfortunately, because every country is using it under the title of combating terrorism. And to combat terrorism, they say we need to tap phones and listen to people if they represent a danger against us. Well, that can be stopped only if every single decision is taken by a justice system, and the justice system is independent. Unfortunately, we don't have that system. Therefore, surveillance will continue, and arresting people because of what they said, depending on the person listening or the software that is collecting the information and consider this as a potential target, this is going to continue in every single country with this spyware or with other developed spyware.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Elijah Magnier, veteran war zone correspondent and political analyst with over 35 years of experience covering West Asia and North Africa. Thank you for your contribution. Richard Becker, thank you. Member of Act Now to Stop War and End Racism from the Answer Coalition. And with
Thanks.
That, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikaba Tafwe, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Health tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the third episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to introduce to you Farabi Hospital in Tehran. a leading hospital in the field of eye surgery and ophthalmology in Iran. Please stay with us. Ophthalmology has been studied and developed in Iran for well over 1,000 years. Traces of this branch of medicine can be found in the writings of some well-known Iranian scientists. For example, the world-renowned Iranian physician Mohammad ibn Zakaria Razi, who lived from 854 to 925 AD, mentions various forms of eye disease in the second chapter of his famous book, Al-Hawi. The book is a medical encyclopedia which served as a reference text for centuries after it was written. Mohammad ibn Zakaria Razi was the first physician doctor to systematically study and write about eye disease. He was also the first physician to study the reaction of the human eye and the pupil of the eye to light. He was also the first to recognize that eye penis is the trachoma disease. It's worth mentioning that Razi's authoritative medical encyclopedia, Al-Hawi, had a major influence on development of medicine and medical practice in Europe for centuries. The book became part of the medical curriculum taught at European universities for centuries. As ophthalmology, in parallel to other sciences, had advanced and developed in recent decades, with doctors and specialists making remarkable advances, Iran has also contributed significantly to this important area of medicine. The Islamic Republic of Iran has successfully trained highly qualified and experienced ophthalmologists and eye specialists who are leading researchers and physicians in this field. Benefiting from experienced doctors and modern medical facilities as well as modern infrastructure, Iran has turned into a pioneering state in the field of ophthalmology, and the role played by Farabi Hospital is certainly significant. The hospital is considered one of the leading centers of ophthalmology in Iran and the West Asia region. Farabi Hospital, established in 1921, is one of the oldest hospitals in Iran. Almost 2 decades after its establishment, Iran's first chair of ophthalmology was founded at this hospital in a building with an area of 13,000 square meters in 1946, where 3-year specialist ophthalmology courses were held. Those students who successfully completed the training courses at the university were able to take part in these specialist courses and become a qualified ophthalmologist after passing the relevant exams and writing a thesis. One of the iconic figures in ophthalmology in Iran is the late Professor Mohammad Oli Shams, who played a key role in eradicating trachoma in this country. In 1957, the first eye surgery operating room was opened in Farabi Hospital and was named in honor of Professor Shams, who also performed the first corneal graft operation in 1934 in Farabi Hospital. Professor Mohammad Qoli Shams is known as the father of ophthalmology in Iran. Farabi's ophthalmology department at first included various sections such as ear, nose, throat, ENT, a lab and pharmacy with 120 inpatient beds, which later expanded to 220 beds. After the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Farabi Hospital was renovated and expanded considerably, offering a lot more specialist services to patients. The expansion of the hospital included the construction of a new building in an area of 23,000 square meters, which was added to the old structure in 1987. The Eye Hospital is now one of the biggest and most well-equipped medical centers of its kind in the West Asia region, offering myriad specialist services for treatment of eye disease to patients who previously used to go abroad to seek treatment. Farabi is a state-run hospital that offers a wide range of medical services at a very reasonable cost. Therefore, the hospital has been able to successfully attract many patients from abroad, especially from countries neighboring Iran as well as from Europe. The cost of treatment at Farabi Hospital compares favorably and is significantly lower than the cost of treatment in European hospitals and hospitals within the Arab world. It's worth mentioning that Farabi Hospital is currently equipped with the most modern and state-of-the-art medical facilities, employing the world's most advanced medical equipment, turning the hospital into one of the best medical centers of its kind in the region. The Farabi Hospital currently has 227 active beds, 57 scientific boards, 80 assistants, and 16 special fellowships. LASIK, commonly referred to as laser eye surgery or laser vision correction, is a type of refractive surgery for the correction of myopia, hyperopia, and astigmatism. Farabi Hospital has a laser eye surgery section, which is equipped with advanced facilities, two operating rooms, and two refractive surgery clinics, keratoconus and cornea keratoplasty, as well as imaging and refraction rooms. Also, one of the most important sections of this hospital is the stem cell processing unit that is in charge of cell therapy, extracting and cloning cells and stem cells. Since its establishment, the Farabi Hospital has always drawn the attention of doctors and ophthalmologists from Iran's neighboring countries, especially Arab countries bordering Iran. Patients from these countries not only receive expert consultation from the hospital's doctors, but also introduce and send the patient to the hospital for receiving diagnostic services to this center, resulting in establishing International Patient Department, IPD, in the hospital for offering suitable services to foreign patients. The IPD department at Farabi Hospital was founded in 2017 with the aim of admitting and facilitating foreign patients' stay in Iran. This IPD department employs the best specialist doctors in the field of ophthalmology. There is also a VIP section for those patients who ask for it. The IPD department of Farabi Hospital is also equipped with 7 rooms for monitoring patients, offering a variety of services for the comfort of patients, such as Wi-Fi, TV, and private WC and bath for each room. The medical staff and nurses are fluent in Arabic and English. Dear listeners, for further information, you can go to the official website of Farabi Hospital, that is http://farabi.tums.ac.ir, or contact the international department of the hospital, that is farabi.vip@tums.ac.ir. Dear listeners, this has been the third episode of our series Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Good morning.
We'll be right back.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.